Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast, sponsored by WebSpy. It's February 8th, 2010, and this is episode 229. I'm actually going to be pre-recording this today. It's only January 31st, but I'm pre-recording this quickly to put something into the stream around February the 8th. So if this is a day earlier or a day late, you'll know why. But basically today, what I wanted to do is just play you a recording from the Focus Ring. I participated in a Focus Ring discussion a few weeks ago, maybe a month or so ago now, maybe not quite that long. But basically, me and three other members, Iberian X Perillo and Jeff Curto and Chris Marquardt, all got together and had a really good conversation. We're taking the Focus Ring in a slightly different direction this year. And I was happy to be in the first episode that we did on the new theme, basically where we select a theme and then talk about images of our own. It's actually very similar to my own podcast in a way, but it's a group discussion about photographs all on a theme. And what I wanted to do today is I'm going to just play this to you, and it's an easy podcast for me in a way, so please sort of forgive me for that part of it. And also, if you already subscribe to the Focus Ring, and you've listened to this, turn it off now, because there's no extra content in here apart from this intro. But the reason that I'm doing this is not only to put something into my own feed while I'm in Hokkaido on the second half of the workshop, but I wanted to bring your attention to the Focus Ring. And basically what the Focus Ring podcast is every so often, and I mean, it's sometimes we go months without doing anything like this, but every so often, and hopefully moving forward, it will be every month, a number of people from the Photocast network get together and record a round table. We call it the Focus Ring. That was just a name that we voted in a while back. But it's an incredible resource, and I wanted to just bring this to your attention today, as well as just get myself a bit of a freebie podcast. In the Focus Ring, we have a whole slew of excellent photography-related podcasts. Of course, I'm one of the podcasts, and I shouldn't really say that after just saying that it's excellent, if I was to try to be modest. But, putting modesty aside, there's a lot of great podcasters that are in the network, and we are adding new podcasts every so often as well. So go over to photocastnetwork.com and check out the list there. We also have some plans to update the website over at the Photocast Network blog during the next few months as well. So we're hoping to take this to another level this year. And this is really the main reason why I'm going to be playing this today. If you haven't already heard of the Photocast Network, do take a listen to some of the podcasts on there. Take a listen to all of them. There are a number of, most of the ones in the top of the list that you'll find on the left-hand side of the page are English, but there's some German, some Spanish and French podcasts in the list as well. So it's not just English content, but really, it's all great stuff. So do take a listen to that if you're, I was going to say if you're interested in photography, but you wouldn't be listening to this podcast if you weren't. So here's the recording. It's slightly over an hour, so it's going to be a long one today. But I hope you enjoy this discussion. I do want to quickly thank our sponsors before we jump into this. So a huge thanks to our sponsors, WebSpy, the Internet Monitoring, Analysis and Reporting Specialists. And as usual, I'd like to ask you to tweet the message. Thanks to @WebSpy for sponsoring the @MartinBailey Photography Podcast on Twitter, if you use Twitter. And that's basically just to show your support. To find out more about WebSpy and their products, go to webspy.com/MBP and use the discount code MBPWSY for a 10% discount on anything that you buy. And I'm not going to put an outro on the end here, so this from this point on, it's basically just the Photocast Network's Focus Ring podcast. I hope you enjoy this.
A short note before beginning this episode. We'll be discussing 8 photographs from all the contributors, and you might want to take a look at the pictures before listening to the show. You can find all the photographs posted on the blog at thephotocastnetwork.com. Well, welcome everyone to the Focus Ring. I don't even know what episode this is. It should be 13 for anyone who cares.
Lucky 13.
And for those of you who don't remember us, which is probably most of you considering the last time we did this.
I'm pretty sure the individuals on this call are going to pimp the hell out of this thing. So everyone, we're going to have lots of listeners on this.
Well, the voice you're hearing right there is Chris Markart from Tips from the Top Floor.
Hi there.
Hey, Chris. We also have joining us Martin Bailey from the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast.
Hi, very next. Hi, guys.
And Jeff Curto from the History of Photography Podcast as well.
And Camera Position. Don't forget
Camera Position. Absolutely.
Hey, how are you?
And this is Ivadi and Exparello from The Candid Frame. So I bought this cadre of infidels together to to try and do a little something different. I mean, I listen to all the podcasts that are out there, and since we all started this thing several years back, I've noticed that there are a lot of shows now that bring a group of photographers together to talk about, you know, photography and technical stuff and software, and I thought, well, let me try something novel with this group, and let's actually get a group together and actually talk about photographs.
Wow. What a concept.
So what we're doing with this show, and maybe for the shows to come, is that we're going to pick a particular topic, and each photographer contributes 2 images, and they talk about those images in relation to the topic. And then the rest of the guys sort of pitch in with questions or comments regarding those photographs and the approach. And hopefully we'll have an interesting discussion that provides some insight into not just the technical side of photography, but also how each of us sees and uses the camera in order to fix that vision into a final photograph. So since I'm the idiot who suggested this idea...
It sounds like an awesome plan,
Baronets. I'll start off here. And the images are going to be available somewhere online, probably at the Photocast Network, and we'll provide a link on the blog for it. And but the images I'm starting off are 2 images. The first one is of a girl in a swim cap, donning a swim cap while the... I forget what you would call that thing. The award stand is behind her. For those of you who can't see the image while you're listening to the podcast, she's donning an orange swim cap. She has a very dark sort of swimming suit on. And there's these sort of award stand steps that are sort of leading away from her. And she's facing into the late afternoon light. So the light sort of cuts across her body, her arm, and her face, and then lights the award stand, and it's angled at such that half the award stand is in shadow. I actually shot this image probably 14 years ago when I was still using film. It was shot using Kodachrome 64, probably on an F4. One of the things that appealed to me, we were a whole group of us from Nikon where I used to be working. We all went into the field this one day to, you know, go shoot, and we went to the Pasadena Aquatic Center where they were having a competition. And while most of the guys were taking pictures of people at the pool, I was really kind of drawn to what was happening with the light at this particular end of the pool. And I was just looking for something interesting to do. And when I saw this girl, I just quickly, you know, started making images. And at the time, I don't think I was as conscious of light as I am now. And one of the reasons I really like this image is just the contrast between light and shadow, and the contrast between color, between the warmth of her skin, the cap, and the coolness of the backdrop and the steps themselves. I was using a 35 millimeter lens there, so I was really working with a very low ISO comparatively to what we have today. And the reason I chose the other image, which is I shot this about 3 or 4 years ago, is of a dog on Hollywood Boulevard. And at this point, I was using digital. I think I was using the 20D. And I forget what lens I probably had on it, maybe the 18-55 or something along those lines. But it's very similar lighting. It's late afternoon light, and this was at the corner of Hollywood and Highland. And the thing I saw here is I was walking down up and down Hollywood Boulevard, and I was really frustrated because I just wasn't finding anything particularly interesting. But I found this patch of light right at the corner of that intersection, and I just propped myself there, and I just waited for subjects to come into that light. And this guy was walking with his dog, and I stopped him, and I said, "Hey, can I take a picture of your dog?" And I made this series of images. And with both images, I was probably, I know with the latter one, and probably for the other one too, I was using center-weighted metering. And center-weighted metering allowed me to bias the exposure for the highlight and allowing the shadow to fall where it would. I think, especially with Kodachrome 64, the latitude that you had with film was pretty limited. So you oftentimes had to expose for the highlight because you couldn't get much shadow detail. And if you did, you'd risk overexposure. But I kind of purposely exposed that image of the dog for pretty as if I was working with a limited dynamic range, emphasizing the highlight. And what that allows me to do is it allows me in camera to emphasize contrast. That starkness between bright and dark, you know, really adds vibrancy to the image. And though one is color and one is black and white, I think it really kind of shows, you know, what can happen with an image when you are very aware of shadow.
I see those two images both being, if you take a camera today and you leave it on whatever automatic mode it is, with matrix metering, you will probably end up overexposing the bright areas because there's so much dark in those images that the camera will just kind of pump it up and bring out the bright areas too bright.
For sure.
So I'm pretty sure the way you worked with the metering here really helped to bring that into the area where you wanted it to be and where it belongs for those pictures.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I still favor using center-weighted or spot metering for those situations, right, just like that, where I go, you know, to heck with the shadows. I don't care about the shadows. I just want to emphasize the highlight. And though I could certainly try and achieve a similar effect in software, it takes a fraction of a second to do it in camera.
Yeah, I've kind of come to the way I approach these things usually is that I do use the matrix metering, so I let the camera kind of do its thing, but I've just out of experience, I know what the camera is going to do in a certain situation, so I do a lot of exposure compensating, and those are both examples where I would have probably dialed in a -1 f-stop exposure compensation.
You know, I think it's kind of interesting the fact that how far we've come, because, you know, Kodachrome 64 was a very low ISO. It was ISO 64, you know, and a lot of the cameras now have like 100 and 200, and now increasingly you have cameras that can shoot at, you know, ISOs of, you know, thousands. And I think it's kind of really interesting to kind of demonstrate that even with the lower ISOs, even if your camera doesn't have that capability, you can still make some amazing images in very sort of challenging light.
You know, Iberonext, I was just thinking, where are we going to send the listeners? Because if people want to look at these images as we're talking about them, maybe we should tell them where they're going to be.
Well, we've yet to figure that out, but I'm sure.
I would expect photocastnetwork.com is a good location to go.
Yeah, we'll put them there, and as we continue to do this, we'll probably find a dedicated place where we can post the images, but
probably head over to photocastnetwork.com and take a look at the top page there. And at least for a while after this is released, the images will be in a post there, I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
And I was gonna say that you might. I'm now wishing I'd stopped. I hadn't added this, but you might put an introductory bit in here saying, you know, you can go find the pictures at. But now you'll want to edit this part out. So I'll just shut up. I'll just shut up now and wait for my turn.
You know that there's no way on earth Iberonex is going to get rid of that. It's there now.
Never mind.
So any comments, Jeff?
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that I've been sort of like jotting down some notes here. One of the things that I find interesting is the idea that with the dog picture, and really with both of these images, but especially with the dog picture, you said, you know, I saw this patch of light and I sat there and waited for something to happen. And I think that alone is an interesting idea, that what we do is sort of seek out not only subject matter that is interesting to us, but subject matter in light that will do something interesting. And I, you know, the dog picture is the one that I keep being drawn to. I mean, I love the color contrast in the swimming cap picture, and the, you know, that wonderful contrast between that rich sort of cyany color and the orange of the swim cap. But the dog picture, and the way the dog is sort of straining toward the edge of the frame, and the quality, the light on the dog, that whole idea of sort of looking for a place to make a photograph that, once you get the combination of the quality of light and then a subject that carries some visual interest, you get a photograph. So I just think that alone is a really interesting notion. I saw this patch of light and I went and you know, finally saw something really cool and said, hey, can I take a picture of your dog?
Yeah, in whenever I'm teaching either online a better photo or doing a workshop, that's one of the big principles that I always harp on, is this idea of like, okay, stop looking at subjects literally. You know, stop looking at that chair as a chair, or is that, you know, or is that, you know, car as a car. Look at what's happening at the light first. See what it's interacting with. And then let that light sort of dictate what your subject matter is going to be. Or if there isn't a subject that sort of allows you to take advantage of the light, just wait, particularly if it's a street scene, because oftentimes on a street there's something that's constantly walking in and out of the light, and sometimes it's just me just standing there, because I was there for, you know, the last 20 minutes of that afternoon light and just making dozens upon dozens of images. So, you know, I probably have about 6 or 7 keepers from that particular shooting situation, where I was just either shooting people as they walk by or stopping them and photographing them in that light.
I've just recently come across this quote about street photography that I so like. It says, street photography is a renewable resource. If you don't like what you see, wait 5 minutes or walk 100 feet.
A renewable resource. That's good. Yes.
I totally like that, because it really, that's what happens. If you shoot in the street, even if you just post yourself and wait at this specific patch of light that gives you so much great stuff to play with, you will have totally different pictures every few minutes.
Yeah. So that's it for me. How about you, Chris? Why don't we start next with you?
Oh, sure.
Well, I've got a few comments about the pictures myself.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, Martin.
It's okay. So I was looking, you know, I mean, I think that I'm not going to just repeat what the other guys have just said here, but the only things that I can think of to add is that, you know, with the dog photo, you know, the expression and everything, I think that obviously the waiting for the light, you know, waiting for something to come into that light and everything, excellent way to work. But I just wanted to say that I love the expression on the dog's face, and the way he's sitting. It's like, you know, oh, geez, I can't walk another foot. He's just keeled over there. But I really like that. The other thing I wanted to talk about, and Jeff touched on this, you know, the color contrast in the swimmer image. These two colors, the main two colors there, you'll probably find if you look at a color wheel that they're exactly opposite. They're, you know, one will be on one side, and if you go 180 degrees around the color wheel, it'll be on the exact opposite side. And so it's, you know, it's one of those things that if people study, not so much study and try and keep a like a mental note, but you know, when you get back, if you find colors that are appealing and you find that they contrast this way, maybe find a color wheel on the web or somewhere. There's one on my website. And just take a look, and you'll often find that colors like this are either exactly opposite or they're a third of the way around. You know, and it's one of these things that, you know, I don't know if it's how the wheel was designed, but it definitely can help you to figure out what's happening in an image and why it's so appealing if you look at those sort of things.
It creates a sort of almost like a vibration,
right?
You know, between those two colors that are opposite one another, and that idea of color contrast as opposed to color that's harmonious, where those colors, harmonious colors are usually much closer to each other on that color wheel, whereas we've got this just, you know, wonderful sort of vibrational contrast. And the fact that the colors aren't exactly together, you know, they don't overlap or anything. It's right. Almost, it's such a weird picture, because it's almost like you could cut it in half, except if you did, you'd lose all of that wonderful combination of color. So, yeah. And I really like in both of Barry and X's pictures that the subject is sort of, you know, compositionally what we'd say is that, wow, that, you know, subject should be looking into the frame as opposed to out of the frame. But in both pictures, both the dog picture and the swimming cap picture, that sort of looking out of the frame forms this really nice sort of tension in the picture, which I think really works.
Yeah, good point, Jeff.
No, yeah, thanks, guys. So, Chris, why don't you go?
Absolutely. The two pictures I chose are both kind of along the same lines. They are both along the darkish line, having lots of shadow and just little light in them. And the reason I chose those are both are kind of monochromatic as well, which is not typical for my usual photography, but I kind of tried to illustrate a concept here, and that is that I like contrast and shadow especially to kind of conceal things from the viewer. Like it's along the lines of challenging the viewer's creativity. I love not to reveal everything right away, and it kind of allows the viewer to come up with their own story because they can fill in blanks. So by not showing everything, I kind of expand the room that the viewer has in the picture, and it's my firm belief that everyone is creative. Everyone has that creative side. Maybe they can't play an instrument, or maybe they can't do photography, but everyone can come up with a story. Storytelling is one of those really old forms of art. There's still places where storytelling is, or storyteller is a profession. I firmly believe that everyone has that in them, and just sometimes people need to be tickled a bit, or maybe shown a picture or something to come up with their own story. So That is what I see the photography like when I go into these dark areas, when I go and hide stuff in the shadows. Both of those pictures actually did have a lot more detail in the dark areas, and I deliberately processed them this way to kind of hide away areas and add a bit of mess. It's not just mystery. It's more opening it up for more interpretation. And then the first picture has been shot at an old factory that has been, I think, out of production for at least 10 years, and it's kind of been taken over by the sprayers, so it's full of graffiti everywhere. And the thing that caught my eye here is the kind of the text here. It says spare time spray love, but it kind of turned into pray love because the shadow hid away the first letter. And then when I posted that on Flickr, someone instantly commented that on his monitor, because he set the contrast too high, he didn't even see the P, so it ended up being spare time ray love, with it, which again kind of corresponds with the lights of the rays of light coming in through the window. And that's another thing I like to do a lot in photography. I like to show cause and effect. Like if I show something that is lit in an interesting way, I try to also include where the light comes from, so the viewer gets the whole picture. And in this picture, you get that. You get the window, and you get the rays of light at the wall, kind of making this diagonal shape at the wall. So you get a very clear impression where the light comes from, how high the sun is outside, or the source of light. And Yeah. The second picture is kind of even more minimalistic, as it's only basically the shapes of light surrounded by these archways, and that was shot in an old bunker at an airport, which is also not run as an airport anymore in Berlin. And that was one of those shots that it took me a while to figure out what I wanted to do there. But when I saw the light coming in this way, and there were some other photographers down, and I just grabbed one and told him, walk past this one wall. And I set the camera. I don't think I used a tripod. I think I just leaned against something, and I set the camera to probably a 15th or a 10th of a second, and just let him walk there and shot a burst of pictures, setting the exposure compensation down minus 2 stops to kind of make sure the highlights don't blow out with that amount of darkness in the picture. And that ended up being a series of pictures, and that's the one that I kept. The other ones I threw away. This is the one that kind of really captured that person in the archway, nicely framed with just the bright light the person is walking into. And I leave it open to everyone to interpret what that means.
Yeah, I really like that image. I especially like the fact that you didn't just wait for something to happen. You just made something happen.
This is totally staged, yeah. Absolutely staged, absolutely.
But it's one of those scenes where it's really all about the light and the shapes and that are created as a result of the direction of the light and how the shadows fall into it. But without that figure, the image really wouldn't be complete. It would be fairly static. And like you said, that person not only provides a context for the space, but it also adds this sort of air of mystery because they're in shadow. And I really love the subtlety of the gradations of light. You have those little bright areas, not in just one part of the frame, but in multiple parts of the frames. And then you have various levels of brightness, and that warmth of the color is really, really good. I don't know what kind of light that you were working with there, but I think that you retain the warmth of the light is a really important part of that, of the success of that.
That was really important for me. The quality of the light always gives you some context and subconsciously tells you what kind of a light source you're dealing with. So it's pretty clear that's some sort of an incandescent light, an old light bulb of some sort that's making this light, and that's almost kind of it's almost warm enough to be like a torch or something.
It's almost like candlelight.
It's almost like a candle. It's not as warm. I kind of warmed it slightly because I kind of wanted this effect to this ambiguity between the light bulb and the candle. So I wanted it to be somewhere in between there.
I love that she's walking. She or he sort of somehow has a feminine presence. I'm not sure why. Like maybe carrying the bag or something that kind of looks like a purse,
it's a leaning,
or something.
I think it's a leaning bag. The leaning back that's giving it a bit more feminine touch. But, even though I think it was a guy, and the reason he's leaning back is because of the camera back. Yeah.
But walking toward that light is really, you know, I think it's one of the things that makes the image. Walking toward the light, I love the intersection of the dark line that must be some sort of, you know, pipe or architectural detail or something there with the eyes, you know, so that there's this sort of like almost like a ray of darkness coming out of the eyes and toward where the light is. You know, the whole thing just really all works together. And, you know, the other thing that's really nice is how much negative space there is, just how much dark area there is around this. You know, if you think about like cropping in, you know, taking, say, the center third or something of this image, what you'd wind up with is something that doesn't have the same drama because there's not as much dark space to work that light off of. So how important is that, you know, that huge expanse of blackness around the subject? That and a lot of people would say, well, you know, Jesus, yeah, this is my subject, I should crop in on that. But boy, I'm glad you didn't. Because I mean, that expanse of darkness really makes the whole thing work.
Yeah, I made a point in leaving a lot of that in, especially to the right hand side, where it's basically a quarter of the picture is just black there, and the person in the picture kind of automatically becomes the subject because your eye gets automatically drawn to the bright areas of the picture, and then that's the only thing that is not architecture. So it has to be the subject all kind of automatically.
Yeah, I find that the I keep looking into the shadows. You know, on the left side, there's that like a box thing, or a, you know, like a some sort of shelving or something along the left. I keep looking into there, and because you just get the gradation starts to come in from the bottom left, and I look along that. I'm thinking, you know, what's in those shadows, and then I'm drawn into the, as Jeff said, you know, with the person walking into the light. You feel like jumping into the shot and moving and trying to get around that corner and go and see what they're looking at, or go and see what's in the light. It's quite compelling.
I think the fact that you achieve this in post-processing brings up an interesting question about when you're out there making images, you know, if you expose for the shadow detail, you can always sort of do it in sort of in post to create that effect. But, you know, I'm just of a school that I prefer to do it in camera. But, you know, either approach is valid. But how much sort of pre-visualizing is involved in both of these images in terms of what you were thinking when you shot it? Were you already thinking about how you were going to process it when you got the images into the computer?
For those two images, pretty much the answer is yes. I kind of saw them this way. For the lower one, the one in the catacombs in the old bunker, that... I just made sure to not blow out the highlights to retain all the detail in there, because I knew that would be really important for that shot. And I had to bring it down a bit in post-processing, but I knew that I could expose it a bit higher and this way retain a bit more detail in the shadows and not have to brighten it up, because that usually raises the noise level in the shadows, but bringing it down is usually not that much of an issue. So that worked really well. For the other one, the first one, that has been that's been a result of my recent analog medium format experiments. I just a month ago got an old Mamiya 645, and I've been playing with some film and been developing stuff over the holidays. So it is pretty close to how I envisioned it, but it came out pretty close as I envisioned it, but. As I used a hybrid approach here, so I did the negative, the black and white negative. I developed that and then scanned that in and continued working on it in the digital realm. This had a lot more detail in the shadows, but again, this was really important for me to add this area where the viewer can kind of start roaming in their minds and come up with their own story about it. So I pull down the darks on that quite a bit too.
But it's sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say it's interesting that, you know, you mentioned about earlier on Iberonex, you mentioned about you know, the pre-visualization, and I remember I did a podcast, I think it was maybe 3 or 4 months ago, about dynamic range, and in there I was, you know, I sort of took a look at where we are today and where we're probably going, and to just sort of, you know, recall a few things from that, the human eye can see like 24 EVs, you know, exposure value, because of the automatic aperture that we've got. You know, the pupil sort of opens up and closes down and that. But if, you know, when you're looking at a shot, as you look into the shadows, obviously your pupil will automatically dilate and you get more light. And as you look into the bright areas, it shrinks down and you get a, you know, you don't get dazzled by the brightness. But your camera obviously can't do that. And although cameras have got roughly the same dynamic range as a human eye, if you were able to stop the pupil from dilating or contracting, I find that, you know, in the future, at the moment that's where we are, but in the future the cameras are going to probably be capturing 24 EV or probably even more than the human eye can with the automatic aperture. And so one of the things that I mentioned at the end of that podcast was that I really want, when it comes to, you know, when the technology advances to the point where it is capturing 24 or more EV, I want to somewhere on the camera, maybe a custom control or a dial where I can control how much dynamic range the LCD has. Because I enjoy looking at the LCD, seeing how plugged up the shadows are, and then really sort of, you know, using that as a way of helping my visualization. Because if the camera showed me exactly what my eyes can see, I wouldn't notice how deep the shadows were really going to be in the resulting image. So, you know, I think the technology is going to go in the in like with everything else, it's going to keep advancing, and we are going to end up with much more dynamic range than we have now. But I'm not sure that I want to capture the information, obviously, but I'm not sure that I want to necessarily see it all on the LCD.
Yeah, you bring up an excellent point about the whole idea that everyone is talking about trying to retain as much shadow detail as possible. But when you look at some of the great images that have been produced, you know, part of it was, you know, the limits of the mediums that they were using. But still, that, that contrast, you look at W. Gene Smith, for example. I mean, he would block up his shadows purposely, even though his film gave him enough latitude to capture it. But he was oftentimes print purposely to emphasize that contrast to provide impact to his photographs.
Exactly, yeah.
That's sort of one of the big, you know, one of the big debates with this, the whole, you know, we've got the HDR phenomenon and the people on either side of the camp with HDR saying, you know, I hate HDR, it doesn't look like photography, and I love HDR, it looks like something new that we can do. You know, the dilemma is that that with this increased dynamic range, we're looking at photographs that don't look like what we're expecting photographs to look like anymore. So, it, and our vision photographically has been tuned to what film did or what digital photography has done up until now. And so now we have these other opportunities and we have to figure out what to do with them. But it's, you know, it's sort of like if you just introduce this wild new flavor in the world and there's, you know, nobody's ever tasted that flavor before, it at first seems really foreign. So we have to figure out how we're going to confront that.
Okay. Yeah. So, Jeff, why don't we lead off with you now?
All right. Well, I have a couple I brought to the table here, a couple of fairly different ideas about light and shadow and contrast and so forth. And one of them is from my continuing exploration of architecture in Italy, and is this photograph of this the front of this church. And it's really sort of interesting that, you know, Baryonyx brought this photograph of the dog and that he saw this light and wanted to do something with the light and waited for subject to happen. I sort of had the same deal, but the opposite way around. I found a subject that I thought was really interesting, but the light was really not that good. So I'd photographed this, the front of this church before in this sort of weird stylized lion and these weird columns and so forth, but something about it didn't work. So I'd gone back two or three times to this same location over the course of a couple of years, and finally figured out that if I was there at the right time of the evening, that as the sun kind of cast a shadow from the rest of the church that is to the left of where I am, that I would be able to put the head of this lion in the light, but have the background behind it be in shadow. So I finally sort of got that whole thing together, and so it's in some ways sort of like that same idea of that Baryonyx had about, you know, going and seeing this patch of light, but I had to figure out when the patch of light was going to happen and how it was going to work, and figure out how to construct a photograph around the idea of the subject that I wanted, but finding the right light to have the subject in. You know, of course, any of you who've worked with this kind of idea before, you know, they have a pretty narrow window. And because I'm shooting this particular picture was shot with a 4x5 camera and black and white film, I kind of had to be there before it all got to where it was going to be. So I got myself set up, having seen it about 5 minutes too late the day before. I got myself set up about 15 minutes beforehand the next day, and got the picture. And then, you know, we'd sort of talked a little bit about metering, and, you know, I typically use a spot meter. You know, I typically don't do kind of photographs that depend on the moment as much as I spend more time sort of doing, I don't know what you'd call it, contemplative photography. So I used a spot meter, and I metered the white stuff, you know, the white columns and the white part of the lion, and then metered the dark church door and figured out that there was enough contrast there that I didn't have to, or not so much contrast that I had to develop the piece of film any differently than a normal development. And then in post-production and scanning the image, I made sure I had plenty of detail in the door and plenty of detail in the white stuff in the lion, and then was able to, you know, kind of manipulate the tones in certain ways to kind of make sure that everybody got the idea that the lion is what it is that I'm particularly interested in. So I guess one of the things that I wanted to bring to the table was this idea of kind of making sure that the contrast and the light and shadow are working for you. So placing this highlighted object against a shadowed object in a certain way that allowed me to kind of tell the story of the situation that I wanted to tell, and these sort of odd architectural details. And, you know, of course, one of the things that I have continued to do over the years as I've photographed these architectural objects is learn more about the architects and the people who built them, and sort of wondering why there's a Celtic knot in an Italian church sort of piqued my interest. So there's a whole bunch going on in here, but the idea of making a compelling photograph to try and, you know, help people look at it long enough to begin to sort of wonder about little details like that is part of what I'm after. So that one I kind of wanted to bring as a kind of plan ahead kind of an idea. And then I brought this other picture to the group here today of some fishing tackle sitting on an old log, and it's part of a story project that I haven't quite exactly figured out how I'm gonna finish yet, but I'm working on creating raw materials for it. And it's about some childhood experiences I had in a place that I go in northern Michigan in the summertime, and my grandfather and my father, with whom I spent a lot of time when I was a kid, doing sort of traditional summertime boy kinds of things. And so here's this fishing gear, and I just found it sitting in the basement, and wanted to, you know, make some pictures that somehow kind of talked about the romance of that experience of going and finding the fishing gear and having the tactile experience of this fishing stuff. And this was shot with a medium format digital camera, a Leaf digital back. And of course, you know, one of the dilemmas we have with these digital cameras is the propensity for the highlights to blow out. So again, I was spot metering with my Pentax digital spot meter and making sure that highlight didn't go out over the edge of the exposure range. And at the same time, I had the dilemma. I was just using window light. So there's just this sort of basement window that's casting light on the subject, no other light in the space, and a fairly lengthy exposure because the light was really dim, and I didn't really want to change the quality of the light because I loved the sort of soft quality of the light. But my dilemma was that the light was really too contrasty, even though it was very diffuse coming through the window. So what I needed to do was I ended up, because I didn't have any appropriate reflectors with me, ended up going into the house and getting a white bed sheet and sort of stringing it up so that I could bounce some light back into the shadows a little bit and begin to separate the fishing reels from the log and so forth and so on. And I'm not sure if it'll play on screen as well as it plays in a print of the image, but it you get just enough separation to be able to know where the fishing reel ends and where the log picks up. So, of course, I just played with lots of different sort of organizations of the two fishing poles and the two fishing reels, and looking for the angle of incidence of how the light reflected off of this sort of I don't know what you call that kind of metal, like spun or brushed metal of the foreground fishing reel, but trying to make sure that I didn't blow out the highlight, but still managed to make it look like it was super shiny and yet aged at the same time. So making sure that I dealt with the dynamic range that was capable, that my equipment was capable of, and making sure that I had a technical solution to the underlying aesthetic problem of wanting to have a kind of romantic soft lighting. So that's what I brought along to the show today. So,
now you brought two very, those pictures couldn't be any more different.
Yeah, I kind of thought about that. I kind of thought, well, you know, especially anybody who's been listening to camera position knows a lot about the Italian photographs because that's primarily what I do. I wanted to bring something really different with this fishing pole picture, because I have this whole other side of what I do, and I tend to be conceptually motivated. I tend to be idea driven rather than subject driven in terms of the way I approach photography. So I have this notion of trying to figure out a way to talk about the importance of people and events and experiences in my childhood, and I'm sort of trying to figure out ways that you can portray that photographically to be able to begin to tell that story or explain that experience.
The fishing rod picture to me has a real studio type quality, and I think that's because you really took control of the light here. I mean, you had the light given to you from the window, but you certainly placed those two fishing rods, and you took you brought the bed sheet to fill in the shadows. So you really took a lot of care to bring the dynamic range into that range that you wanted it to be in. That gives it a very, to me, that my instant feeling when I looked at that picture was, that is a planned shot. That is not an accidental shot.
Yeah, it's planned down to the, you know, there's a couple of pieces of chewing gum stuck up underneath the right hand fishing reel to get it to be propped up to the right angle so that the light comes off of the reel at the right spot. I had a bunch of wood chips and other stuff, and they kept sort of sliding in inappropriate ways. So I ended up grabbing a couple of pieces of chewing gum and chewing them up and sticking them under there, because I didn't have all of my little tacky wax and all the stuff that I would have in a studio, because I was, you know, out in the field. So in the field, you make do. Bed sheets instead of real reflectors, and you know, as long
yeah,
as,
you improvise. As long as you can move the subject around or get a bed sheet, that is, no one will be able to tell in the final picture.
Yeah, except for you know, this is a house that my mother owns and still lives in the summertime, and you know, the only dilemma was, you know, irritating my mom about bringing the clean white bed sheet down into the dirty basement. just for any of you who are out there who have, you know, moms, you kind of get that. Doesn't matter how old they are. What true. Are you doing with that?
Well, I, for one, am glad I don't have to clean up after you.
Well, sticky chewing gum everywhere.
Just been here.
Yeah. You know what? I think, you know, I totally agree with everything that's been said. A great improvisation here, Jeff. And the... you know, a couple of things I wanted to mention about this, the fishing tackle image is that I love the way you've aligned it all up so that it's sort of going off at a diagonal down into the left corner, all pointing out in the same way. And then that float or whatever it is, with looks like a copper fish with red eyes, that's also like looking out that way. Kind of like with the Baronex's images earlier with the... you know, the both the subjects facing out of the image. I think you've done that sort of pseudo art with these pseudo eyes on the fish thing. And I also really like the depth with the way you've got the log, where you can see down it. You've obviously thought about how you've lined it up with the logs so that you can see down the depth of that. And then, of course, you've got the depth of field is shallow enough that we don't see the floor and everything in sharp focus, which is really nice. And then the last thing I wanted to mention here is that I like the tight crop. You know, I feel as though I want to see what the whole reel is on that with the yellow twine stuff up there, and I want to see a little bit more of that, but it's just enough to give me some tension without sort of making me feel like it's overly cropped. So I just wanted to really mention that. And on your Italy shot, I just love the way that that lion, you've waited until the light is, you know, the shadow is just so that it's cutting off the background but not the head of the lion. So it's, you've created a really nice contrast there. So just a couple of comments that I wanted to throw in.
Yeah, and I think the Italy shot just brings, oftentimes when people are traveling, they're in such a rush, but, you know, you show a great example of, if you find a great scene and time allows, come back to it when you know the light's going to be better. You know, it's so well worth it. I think, you know, so many of us are just, you know, rushing to see something and moving on to the next thing. As a photographer, if you find a great location and you know it's working, you know, finagle some way of being able to get back there when the light is just sweet.
But, see, that's the excuse that I use every year to go back to Italy. You know, the fact that there's really great food and wine and, you know, beautiful landscape and great people and all that stuff just happens to be a kind of a bonus.
Yeah, I think the way that you shot that with a 4x5 camera means you have to set it up. You have to take your time, and that kind of goes along with this very thoughtful way of planning it and planning and coming back to it. Whereas a lot of the digital photographers I see being in a rush, because that's kind of what the digital world leads towards. And I've totally noticed that over the last few months doing more analog work again, that really takes out a lot of the speed, and it kind of brings you back into thinking more about the shots and taking your time. I used to do 35 millimeter analog. Now I do some medium format analog, a 6x7 centimeter film. That gives you how many pictures on on a roll film? 8 exposures, I think. Which is nothing compared to the hundreds of exposures you get on a small memory card these days. So it really, the analog way of working really slows you down and takes a lot of the rush out of things. And that has been a very healthy experience, because I kind of almost had totally forgotten about that over getting so much into digital, that sometimes it's actually better if you take your time, if you plan out something, and if you meter twice or three times to make sure you really capture the latitude of the scene.
And another, go ahead.
Well, the other thing I wanted to say about the rod and reel shot is just your position relative to the light. You're shooting from the shadow side of the subject matter. And I think that really is one of the things that helps, you know, provide the shot. Its impact is shooting from that perspective rather than having the camera positioned on the sunny side, on the bright side, where the overall scene would have been a lot more flat. And I think that's something I think photographers need to consider when they find a subject and they're considering shadow, is like, we're oftentimes shooting from front light, but what if you just go 180 degrees and shoot from the other side? How much more impact do you get as a result of shooting from that perspective?
Well, that's why Jeff's podcast is called Camera Position and not Shoot From Anywhere and Hope It Works.
Exactly. That would have been a good... Too long. Shoot From Anywhere and Hope It Works. Welcome to Shoot From Anywhere and Hope It Works. Glad you could join me.
Yeah. And now sister podcast, just Spray and Pray.
Spray.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, actually, that sort of ties into what I wanted to say, is that I had the really great fortune of being in New York City in October and saw the Robert Frank, the Americans show at the Metropolitan Museum. And there were a couple of things about the show that was really interesting. And, you know, many of us know that body of work from the book The Americans, and the sequencing of it is so important. And so they had, you know, large, like 16 by 20-ish size images of the book's images in sequence. But the other thing that they had that was just so fabulous were Frank's original contact sheets with his grease pencil markings of which images he thought were important. And one of the things that just really floored me is how few pictures this guy made relative to the iconic images that we know. So the pictures that we know that from Robert Frank in terms of what he made and, you know, what we know of his work, you know, you might think that, you know, all he did was shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot, but a lot of the times there were just maybe one or two at the most frames for some of these pictures that we think of as being these sort of masterpieces of street photography. So it doesn't have to be the spray and pray strategy. What he was able to do that I'm not able to do is speed up that process of planning ahead. So I found that to be really intriguing.
That's awesome, though. You humble me by that fact, man. You know, considering how few in the images, because I wouldn't have thought that about his work. But
oh, it's really in the Metropolitan has I think it's the National Gallery in Washington has a book about the exhibition that's really interesting and has a lot of those contact sheets in it, and it's really just worth looking at, because you know you do tend to think that, gosh, this guy must have just shot so much in order to get these images. And a lot of times it's just, you can tell that he was shooting one thing and he turns around and sees this other thing and pops off one picture. And it's the picture that winds up being sort of one of the icons of modern photography. So well worth a look.
Well, next, let's hear from our man in Japan.
I like that. I almost registered that domain name. Your man in Japan. Okay, so I chose two shots. You know, we're talking light and dark, light and shadows. And so I also chose a colored one. But we'll look at the light and the dark one first. It's two flowering lotuses or lotus flowers. And this is really, I chose this image because I wanted to talk a little more about plugging up those shadows. And like I was saying earlier with the dynamic range stuff, I find that, you know, that when I was looking at this scene, it was basically these two flowers that were catching the late afternoon light. And the background was a lot of green trees. There was a little bit of distance, but they were more in the shade. So basically, you know, you got the highlighted, fully lit lotus flowers, and then some green trees in the background that are fully in the shade. And of course, when I look at the trees, I get this thing where, you know, my eyes will do the little aperture change, and I'll end up with seeing a lot of detail in the trees, but my camera, when I look at the LCD, is showing me two white flowers and nothing else. And in fact, you know, the LCD had less dynamic range than the image, because when I got back and looked at the images, there was a little bit more detail in the background. I could see some patches of green, and in fact, between the two flowers, you can see that there is a little bit of lighter gray. I've obviously converted this to black and white, but what I did here was concentrated. I know we all are, but you know, some people don't, with the digital age, some people aren't so worried about controlling the exposure, and you know, because you can do so much with RAW. But I'm very careful to not blow out my highlights unless it's specular highlights that I'm not going to worry about. So I wanted to make sure that I kept all of the detail, the beautiful gradations and texture in the flower. Just really, you know, exposed for the highlights, as I usually do. And then I, in post-processing, I just grabbed that black slider and just moved it a little bit further across to really plug up the blacks. And I find that what that did is give us a really nice contrast between the white flowers, the texture, and then the blacks there. But, you know, that's with a black and white photo, you know, obviously you're only dealing with the monochrome sort of side of it. The other image that I brought up that I wanted to talk about today was just really totally the opposite scale. This is I entitled this Color Collaboration, and really, this is an image that I made at the end of November, I think it was, just a few months, a month or so ago. And here, what I wanted to do is just talk about the light or the luminance or the reflectance or reflectivity of various colors. Because it, you'll see here, you know, it's a very bright, highly saturated image. But you'll notice that the yellows are... This scene was totally evenly lit by an overcast sky. And yet the yellows are much more reflective than the reds and the greens in the foreground here. And in fact, if you take this image and make it, you convert this to black and white, then your yellows become almost white and the reds and the greens become a very similar mid-tone gray. So, you know, when you're talking about highlights and darker tones, you know, lights and darks in images, you can also use color in a similar way and sort of, you know, bring out, although I've put the darker or the less reflective reds and greens in the foreground, the yellow leaves in the background there definitely dominate the image. And of course, that's because I focused on them with a very shallow depth of field. And the other thing that I wanted to mention here as well is just that, you know, going back to the dark, the shadows, I placed the trunk of a tree over on the right side there. And that's really the darkest part of the image. There's a bit of a patch of dark in the other areas as well, but you don't really even need to have the shape of the tree totally defined for you to know what it is, just because there's that dark patch there in that shape. But yeah, I mean, really, those are the things, just controlling the exposure that I wanted to talk about, and then the fact that we can also use lighter and darker colors in a similar way.
Boy, that one little blip of tree trunk in the lower right corner is the thing that keeps it from being this totally abstract study of leaves. I mean, it really places us in a scene. It's fascinating. I was just sitting here, you know, putting my finger over the tree trunk and how big a difference that makes. And it's, I think, a combination of knowing that it's a tree trunk, but also the fact that it's this dark object in the lower right corner.
Right.
And it kind of grounds the picture.
Yep. It really does. It's fascinating. That kind of stuff just blows me away about photography every time, that, you know, just eliminating that detail changes everything about the picture.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's those small little elements, because I think a lot of our images, you know, shadows play a real pronounced role in the overall composition. But even with this particular image, it just shows it doesn't have to, you know, be half the frame or three quarters of the frame. It can just be a small little patch of darkness or shadow that all of a sudden provides a context for the entire frame. Because I think for an image like this, the obvious appeal is the color, and I think we would tend to just compose this shot and just fill it with color. But by you adding just that bit of information in terms of just shadow, all of a sudden the entire image ends up working and is so much more effective than it would have been had that been excluded.
I took a lot of I worked this scene for maybe not a whole lot of time, maybe 10, 15 minutes. But this was, I actually podcasted about this a few weeks ago as well. It's one of those images that I made rather than just sort of stumbled across, because it's actually, I also put out on my blog, I put a 14 millimeter shot of the whole scene, and it's very difficult to see this shot. I shot it with a 300 millimeter with a 1.4 times extender or teleconverter on. So I'm shooting at 420 millimeters here, and just have to be in exactly the right place to get the green and the red and the yellow and then the purple and everything, all of these trees, to get them all in line. It was a little bit of a study in observation, and I was just making a point that, you know, people go to these places and don't always try to make an image like this. They'll often sort of try to capture as much as they can, because, you know, with the angle, the wide angle eyes that we've got, we generally see the world a lot wider than this, and so people tend to try to capture it that way. But I often find that singling out a very small part of the image can help us to really concentrate on that And I worked where I put that that trunk for a couple of minutes as I wrapped up on this shoot.
I think seeing what such a thing does to your picture, the color, and we always see color with our eyes, kind of makes it difficult sometimes to see all the details, because color, I mean, red is so much more strong than green, for example, and yeah. It pulls your eyes towards it. One of the things that I've seen people do, and I think it's really effective, is if you don't really see the dark and bright of a picture because of all the color in it, switch to your live preview if your camera can do that, and switch that to black and white, and look at the world around you in black and white, and it can really help. It's a good tool to teach you to see just the shapes and just the bright and dark and not the colors, and this might help to discover something like this trunk in there. That makes a lot of sense there.
With the 4x5 camera, the live preview is just take the film holder out.
Which is true, but then it's all upside down.
No, I've always explained to everybody, it's never upside down. It's just you have to turn the camera upside down, and then it's all okay.
Oh, I see. Okay.
See? It all works.
but actually, to be honest, that helps. I mean, I see that now looking at the composition on the medium format camera. That the thing is mirrored left to right, at least, so that already kind of puts some level of abstraction into the scene, and that will also help you discover shapes that you wouldn't see otherwise, because if you see the picture upside down, if you see it the right way, and if you see it the normal way, you will just look at it with all those preconceptions, whereas if it's upside down, if it's kind of abstracted, you will see it in a different way, and you will discover things that you wouldn't have seen otherwise.
And I think one of the interesting elements about the other shot, about the two flower buds, is those are two flowers that are juxtaposed against each other. One is sort of overlapping the other. The one is sharper than the other. But it's the shadow that exists on the second bulb that creates separation between the two, because if they were both evenly lit, they may have just become lost into each other. But even though the first thing you look at is the sharp contrast between the really black background and the white bulbs, there's still some shadow happening in between the two that, even though it isn't as dark, is really important for the success of that photograph.
Yeah, that's a great observation.
I just... you know, I've got all eight of the images we've been talking about in a browser here, and I just rotated them all upside down and flipped them horizontally so that they'd be like view camera pictures, and it's really interesting to do. I mean, it's certainly one of the things that I do in classroom critiques a lot is, you know, turn things upside down and look at them upside down, and it's interesting to see all of these pictures upside down and to see how they work upside down. It's a really great way to kind of examine the composition. The weirdest one is Abarianex's cyan stairs and orange swim cap, because it's almost like the stairs almost work exactly the same way that they did right side up. It's kind of an odd picture. So that is something
for everyone to try out there. Flip your pictures upside down and just have a look at them in a different way.
Well, that was really interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know about you guys, but I had a lot of fun actually discovering that you guys know what you're talking about.
Well, how could you have doubted that?
Oh, but we stacked the deck. We took pictures we already knew. Oh, wait a minute. Right. There were the other pictures that other people didn't know. So,
we do know what we're doing. That's the thing. We probably should say that, I mean, at least for me, and I'm sure for you, even for you guys, we've all only had really a few minutes to look at these images. And,
yep,
and you know,
that's true.
So I think it's been a good exercise. Looking through them like this and discussing it.
I'm just looking at that stair picture upside down now, and it looks so weird.
Isn't it great?
It's absolutely wonderful. I like it. You should probably hang that upside down, Baronex.
I'll pass on that.
But the, you know, intriguingly, that like it works really well upside down, but the dog picture doesn't work very well upside down at all. You know, even though they're, you know, they're both pictures that have faces in them and so forth and so on. So it's interesting.
The stair one is wacky. That's cool. I like that.
I think what's most fascinating is the fact that, you know, we all are very different photographers, you know, but we're all using pretty much the same materials for the most part in terms of light and composition and focus and all that other stuff. And you can see how all of that, you know, really plays a role in how each of us sees, you know. Yeah. And, you know, Jeff is using film, the other guys are using digital, but everyone's using whatever medium they're using in a very distinctive way. And it's one of the things that I was hoping that this sort of dialogue would provide is for listeners to discover that there isn't just one way of doing this thing. Oftentimes we get locked into listening to someone pontificate about an approach, and then they believe that, okay, this is the only way to do it. And I think this kind of demonstrates that, you know, with a camera and with your eyes, you know, all bets are off. And it's just about you being able to use these tools to be able to capture that vision that you have on your head into that final frame.
And if you ever meet a photographer who tells you that there's only one way to do that, walk away.
Then they don't know what they're doing.
Exactly.
And if they say that they have every answer to everything, also walk away.
Yes. Well, I'm still trying to look up pontificate.
That's you know why? That's because you're English and it's, you know.
Well, to tell you the truth, I actually looked it up in an English-Japanese dictionary because I often find that I can figure out what it means more by looking at the Japanese than I can by a thesaurus and stuff.
Hey, and with your English accent, you can say it even if you don't know what it means, and it sounds impressive.
Exactly.
Well, guys, why don't you remind people where they can find you?
Absolutely. I'll kick ahead, it off. Tipsfromthetopfloor.com, or even better, chrismarquardt.com. Chris, MARQUARDT.com.
And I'm Jeff Curto at camerapositioncom and photohistory.jeffcurto.com.
And I'm Martin Bailey. You can find me, everything's linked from martinbaileyphotography.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter with Martin Bailey with no space or underscore or anything.
Yeah, and we're all on Twitter, right? You know, I know that I don't know that I'm following Martin, but I know that I'm following Chris and Baryon X, and I'm finding that to be a really interesting medium to communicate with other photographers and other people around the globe. So
I'm hurt, Jeff.
I'm going to go follow you right now.
Well, where can we find you?
And you can find me at, where can I be found? At thecandidframe.com. Also, you can follow me on Twitter just by following the name EbodyNX.
Oh, wait, I am following you, Martin. I'm sorry.
He's just been ignoring you.
No, I've just been egging you. Sorry.
Well, thanks, guys. I think this was great, and it looks promising. So we'll see what the response is, and more than likely we'll be doing this again sometime.
Yeah, let's have listeners let us know what they think, whether they want us to do more of this kind of stuff.
And you can do that by visiting thephotocastnetwork.com and posting a message on the blog there, and let us know what you think. And if you have some topics that you think would be interesting for us to discuss, pass those along as well. So,
absolutely.
Thank you guys very much. I'm having my cup of coffee now, and it's time for me to wake up.
Yeah, good morning.
Right. It's time for me to go to bed.
All right. Sleep well. Wake up well.
Check out this show and more great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com. photocastnetwork.com.